This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
Yeah, sure thing.
Hey, you sold that car yet?
Yeah, sold it to Carvana.
Oh, I thought you were selling to that guy.
The guy who wanted to pay me in foreign currency, no interest over 36 months? Yeah, no. Carvana gave me an offer in minutes, picked it up, and paid me on the spot. It was so convenient.
Just like that.
Yeah.
No hassle.
None.
That is super convenient.
Sell your car to Carvana and swap hassle for convenience. Pickup fees may apply.
What kind of programs does this school have? How are the test scores? How many kids do a classroom? Homes.com knows these are all things you ask when you're home shopping as a parent. That's why each listing on Homes.com includes extensive reports on local schools, including photos, parent reviews, test scores, student-teacher ratio, school rankings, and more. The information is from multiple trusted sources and curated by Homes.com's dedicated in-house research team. It's all so you can make the right decision for your family. Homes.com. We've done your homework.
From a player's perspective, when I was playing, we had a jersey, an alternative. I love the home whites, the road grays, and that's how I was. I felt good in it. I felt like I was going to win. I felt like I was going to have a good game when I put my uniform on. Anytime we had that silly blue jersey that I had to wear on Sunday, I felt like I had my BP jersey on, and I couldn't stand it. So I didn't like it as a player, but I see what's behind it from a marketing standpoint. I think it's brilliant. You guys had all the uniforms before anybody did. Did you like that, or did you like more of a uniform? I know what I'm wearing every day, or were you just at the point where it doesn't matter? That's what these guys do.
Well, for most of my career, when I first came up, the Pirates, first of all, when they moved from Forbes Field to Three Rivers, were the first team to wear double knit uniforms. Everybody else was wearing flannels before that. So
right.
We went into the lighter weight material, and that was nice. They weren't the multicolored ones. They were just, you know, grays and whites and the usual
right.
combination. But then in 77, it was when we went to the set of three different color combinations, and you mixed the black pants with the gold shirts and whites and white pinstripes and all kinds of stuff. I didn't mind them. The one good decision that they made right away was we never got to pick out what uniforms we were wearing because they wanted to avoid John Candelaria wants to pitch in a gold shirt and a black pair of pants every time he pitches.
Right.
And Parker likes to wear this. And so that conflict was all taken care of. A secretary in the office picked out what uniforms we wore. So we wore whatever it was. The problem with them was there were three sets of uniforms. So that means you got six uniforms, which means you got two different sets of undershirts. You got two different hats. You got two different pairs of socks. You got gold socks. You got black socks. You got all these different parts. The equipment bag wasn't big enough to put all these damn uniforms in. Because by the time you put all the uniforms in, you didn't have any room for your gloves and your spikes because you had so damn many uniforms in there. So
right. You had to double up. You
know, so, you know, and then your locker is just full of, you know, all these different uniforms and stuff. But I did like the fact that the different looks. Now, they did, Major League Baseball did eventually, I think it was the second year, we had an all-black uniform, black pants, black tops with gold socks and gold sleeves. And they came up with a decision, probably rightfully so. We were not allowed to wear those uniforms at night games. yeah. because of the all-black uniform under lights didn't show well. So that was the only restriction that we had on the uniforms. But I liked all the different combinations. I thought it was good. And the fact that, you know, we weren't, it wasn't a problem in the clubhouse because I wanted to wear this uniform. Somebody else wanted to wear that uniform. That was taken out of our hands. So I really did like the uniform. Now, there were a couple combinations that weren't the best looking in the world. And I always joke when we were playing the Orioles in the World Series in 79, that might have been the ugliest two sets of uniforms that any World Series teams ever wore, because everybody was either, you know, white and gray most of the time.
Right.
You know, and the Orioles had the orange tops and the black pants, or the black or the black tops and the orange pants. We had the gold tops and the black, and we had all, you know, there were more colors running around. You look around on the bases, and there, you know, there were all kinds of different colors everywhere. It's like a carousel. So, you know, it was interesting in the World Series to see those color combinations that you weren't used to seeing during the regular season when one team was the home team and the other team was the road team. And we didn't. Nobody had the beautiful Dodger pure white uniforms.
Right, right, right.
Yeah, they were always iconic, and I always liked those too. But it was unique with the uniform combinations, and I wore them for almost my whole career. Plus, the other part was our pants always had elastic waistbands to them. So we never wore belts. The whole time I played in Pittsburgh, I never wore a belt. And we had the hats. I got traded to Philadelphia for the first 2 weeks of my time in Philadelphia. Every single day, we'd get dressed, we'd be going out to batting practice, and somebody'd look at me, "Teak, go back in, put your belt on." I would put my pants on, I would hook them up, and I wouldn't put a belt on because I had never worn one before. So they'd have to stop me and send me back in to get me completely dressed. Here I am, a 15-year veteran, and I got to be reminded to put my belt on every day because I'm not used to wearing
it. Well, you hadn't done it. It was kind of like when the game was over back in those days. Then you guys would go from your uniforms to the Sansa belts, which also didn't have a belt in them either.
Oh, and I wore all Sansa belts. I never wore a pair of slacks off the field that didn't have a belt.
Exactly. And you know, I think it comes down, for me as a player, it's, let's be real honest about it. Why didn't I like the alternative blue shirt? Because probably the first couple times I wore them, I didn't get any hits. And that's all that mattered. If I would have got hits, I would have probably loved those alternative jerseys that
well,
were.
Well, either that, that they or, made us it, you know, either that or, it, you know, it was like putting on a softball jersey.
It
didn't fit with what you were used to.
Exactly.
And it took us a little while when we first got started to, to get used to the color combinations. But eventually you became accustomed to it. You got accustomed to looking at it because it was there every day.
Talk about, and I want to get to you and your career a little bit, and this rubber band man thing. I've been playing since I knew you were coming on the podcast. I've been playing this song on my it kind of brings me back that old tune from the Spinners. And everybody thinks, you know, in my generation, we had Trevor Hoffman with Hell's Bells, and it was great. Even when I wasn't, you know, we were teammates 1 year, but usually I was his opponent. And when Hell's Bells was being played in San Diego, that usually wasn't good for us because Trevor was coming in.
He knew what was coming.
9 times out of 10, the game's over. We're losing, and here comes Trevor. Same when you go to Yankee Stadiums with the great Mariano Rivera, Enter Sandman. But you kind of had a walk-up song before there was the term walk-up song with Rubber Band Man, and it kind of took on a life of itself when you'd come out of the bullpen.
Yeah, well, it was interesting is, you know, back then there were only a couple of us. There really wasn't walk-up music per se. Vince Lashide, our organist, used to actually play songs for the opposing hitters. if he would find something that was catchy to related to their name. So that would, there would be some music there. But typically, hitters didn't have walk-up music. Players or relievers, whatever, didn't have entrance music. The Rubber Band Man was Vince Lashide's creation. And it was an interesting, because number one, you know, I pitched every day, and you know, the odd delivery and all the other stuff. So the Rubber Band Man thing, and then, you know, the way it started out was, you know, just boom, 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 you know, and then the way the song was timed, and I think the Spinners had like four or five different versions of it that were different lengths. Well, there was one version that they used that when I would walk through the bullpen gate in the left field corner and walk toward the mound, as soon as I would open up the gate, the song would start. Boom, 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 boom. And okay, so that kind of lets the crowd know I'm coming. It plays all the way while I'm walking in. Chuck hands me the ball. I go ahead and I, you know, do my usual thing, throw my warm-up pitches. I get done throwing my eight warm-up pitches. It's time to start the game. The song, that version of the song ended right then. The timing was perfect. I mean, they didn't have to cut it off. It just ran, and my timing of coming in and warming up and everything was the same. So I became identified with the Rubber Band Man, and the fact that it, you know, it had the upbeat start. It was going to be a tight situation. We were at home. You know, get the crowd into it and everything else. The only other one that I can remember that had a walk-up song or had an entrance song at that point in time was Bruce Sutter. He had one in Chicago. But his was the Alka-Seltzer commercial. Plop, plop, fizz, fizz, oh, what a relief it is. So it was rather more brief and didn't fill the whole time. The thing with the Rubber Band Man was it filled the entire time from when I walked onto the field till I got ready to pitch. So the momentum and the noise and everything never really let up and just led right into the at-bat.
Nerds!
Today's episode is sponsored by Smart Travel, a new podcast from NerdWallet. Smart Travel doesn't just cover points and miles. They break down all the financial aspects of your trip, whether that's the best days to book, how to avoid hidden fees, or which fancy travel credit cards pay off, and which ones are just an expensive flex. If you want your travel budget to work harder, then dive into the best deals, products, services, and more with Smart Travel from NerdWallet, wherever you get your podcasts.
If you love your phone, but not your carrier, just switch to T-Mobile. You can keep your phone, keep your number, and we'll help pay it off up to $800 per line. You can also use our savings calculator to compare our plans and streaming benefits against Verizon and AT&T. So, switch and keep your phone, keep your number, and keep more of your moolah at T-Mobile.com.
Up to 4 lines via virtual prepaid card. Allow 15 days. Qualifying unlocked device credit service ported in 90 plus days with device and eligible carrier and timely redemption required. Card has no cash access and expires in 6 months.
Hey, it's Jim Costa with Cash the Ticket. Mike Valeni and I are all over the tournament again this March. Breakdowns of every region and every game, who are the Cinderellas, and which team's cutting down the nets. Subscribe and listen to Cash the Ticket on the Odyssey app, wherever you get your podcasts.
Your style. And back then it was, you know, I was trying to think of the older players that threw similar to you. Dan Quisenberry comes to mind. Gene Garber, but not really. Gene Garber was a sidearmer. Eckersley, who I faced the first half of my career, he was more of a sidearmer. You were a submariner. You came down lower than those guys. Quisenberry, I think, got down there. There's a couple guys in today's game that do. I've faced a few throughout my career. But where did that come from? Were you ever over the top? Is that where you just settled in as a pro? Tell me all about it.
Well, I was always tall and skinny. When I was 9 years old, I was tall and skinny. Wasn't very strong, but I had long arms and long legs, so I had leverage. That's how I could develop power, with my long arms and my long legs. So I was a natural sidearm. That was the first time my dad played catch with me in the backyard, I threw the ball to him sidearm. And I've stayed that way all the way until I was in double A ball. I pitched the same way, sidearm, like Bruce Kiesen. If you remember Bruce.
Yeah, I remember Bruce. Yeah.
Okay, we were like twins. We were built the same. We threw the same. He threw a little bit harder. But so I was going along and I was, you know, doing well. But it was starting to get to the point where the hitters were starting to hit me a little better. And what an old scout that was watching this told me, he says, what's going on, Teak, is when your ball is around the perimeter of the strike zone, just outside of the strike zone, it's moving really well. It's sinking, it's sliding, it's doing all the stuff it's supposed to do. When it's legitimately getting into the strike zone, now it's straightening out. It's not moving as much.
Flat.
So as the hitters were getting better, not swinging as many of the balls off the plate, they were getting better pitches to hit on the plate, and I was starting to get hit harder. He says, you got to find some way to come up with that movement in the strike zone. So, you know, you start playing around with different things, and I tried to throw overhand and, you know, be normal, and that didn't work at all. And I went back. Now, what I came up with was a 10-year-old man. I grew up in Cincinnati. There was a guy, a veteran reliever by the name of Ted Abernathy. He pitched for the Cubs. He pitched for the Reds. I think he pitched for the Braves for a while. He did fairly well. He was a tobacco farmer out of North Carolina. And he threw submarine. Well, we were in double A one day, and for some reason playing catch in the outfield, Ted Abernathy, the memory of a 10-year-old memory of Ted Abernathy pops into my head. And I go, yeah, Abernathy. And I, you know, instead of throwing sidearm, I throw it submarine. And the guy that I was playing catch with, I mean, we're just in the outfield during batting practice. It hit him in the shin. The bottom just fell out of it. And I'm going, wait a minute. We might have just found something here. You know, I knew right away, okay, now we got the movement in the strike zone. What it took me a couple of years to figure out was, okay, if I'm going to go down here, how am I going to throw a breaking ball from down here? Because in those days, you didn't want breaking balls that went up. You wanted something that was going to move down, trying to get them to hit on top of the ball to get the ball on the ground. So it took me a couple of years to develop that. But that delivery in that slot, two things happened. Number one, I got the movement in the strike zone. And surprisingly, by dropping down there, I added about 3 or 4 miles an hour to my fastball, which then made the movement, the sink, later in the pitch. It was closer to the hitter, so he didn't have as much time to follow the break. It was breaking, you know, this far out in front of home plate, instead of 3 or 4 feet out in front of home plate, made it much more difficult for him to be able to get underneath that ball and get it in the air. So my ground ball percentage went way up when I was able to throw it harder and get that movement down in the strike zone. And that's pretty much, I mean, for 15 years, I've threw two pitches, a sinker and a slider. That was it. I didn't even have a changeup.
That unique style, I got a twofold question. Do you think, because you led the league in innings in appearances 4 times.
Right.
So you're kind of a workhorse. I mean, you can kind of go. Do you think that style lended itself to you could pitch more? Or was that just the way you were built? And mechanically, you know, because we all, as a hitter, I always had hitting coaches, and we'd work on, you know, for me, it was more, where do I want to be when the ball's in the hitting zone? So it was a little simpler. But from a pitching perspective, you and your pitching coach, because you were so unorthodox, was there ever a disconnect there between pitcher and pitching coach because of your style? Or is it like hitting? It doesn't matter. You all, no matter where you release the ball from, you've all got to do certain mechanical things to be successful in the long run.
Well, that is really one of the major changes that took place between my time and your time, particularly for relief pitchers. Relief pitchers didn't spend much time with your pitching coach. You know, they didn't have sessions in between. You didn't have to, you know, work on the curveball, do this, fix what was bad the last time. Number one, because you didn't have time. Number two, if you pitched yesterday and had trouble, you had to pitch again today anyway. So you had to, we pretty much figured it out on our own. The guy that helped me more than anybody else was Grant Jackson, my left-handed partner in the bullpen.
He was our pitcher.
He would watch me in the bullpen, and he could tell when I was starting to do things. I had a couple keys. Number one, if I was following through and my hand came up and I would slap myself on the top of the shoulder, that meant my arm angle was right. If I would come through and my arm would be down underneath here, my arm angle is, he'd say, "Hey, Teague, get the arm back up."
Yeah.
Okay, so we kind of made our own adjustments. So we didn't rely, particularly relievers, on pitching coaches per se. Quick story. I get traded now. I've been doing this for 10 years. I get traded to Philadelphia in 85. Claude Osteen, great pitching coach, great pitcher, is the pitching coach for Philadelphia. Walk in the first day into the clubhouse. "Hi, Claude. Kent, how you doing?" Claude goes, "Teague, I'm going to tell you something. I don't have the slightest idea what you do. So I'm going to tell you what we're going to do." And I got traded over at the end of April. So we got 5 months of the season left. He says, "Whenever you have a problem and you have to make an adjustment," and I'd gotten pretty good about making my own adjustments and figuring out what was wrong pretty quick. He says, "When you make an adjustment, when the inning's over with, come in, sit down next to me, tell me what the problem was, how you fixed it, and we're going to do that for the rest of this year. And then next year, I'll know what your problems are, how you adjust, and then..." Because you can always, a coach can see what you're doing wrong before you can feel it. So he can help you make an adjustment a pitch or two quicker than you having to figure out, okay, this is what's going on and this is what I got to do to fix it. But I was, again, like the Gary Maddux thing, I was surprised as could be that I've got a borderline Hall of Fame pitcher who's my pitching coach, it's been a great pitching coach, is walking up to me the first day and saying, "I don't have the slightest idea what you're doing. You're going to have to teach me." Pitching coaches don't do that. That's their territory. That's their responsibility.
Right.
Yet he's telling me, "I don't know how to fix you. You're going to teach me so that next year I can fix you."